Hailing Frequencies Open, and welcome to Enterprising Individuals, the Star Trek discussion podcast that boldly goes into excruciating detail about the series, characters, and stories of the Star Trek universe. I'm your host, Aaron Coker, a.k.a. Caliban, and if you're looking for a name for a moon infested with fungal spores, may I suggest Zyrtectron? My girlfriend wrote that joke. I'm joined once again on this episode by Annika Dane and Liz Barr, the hosts of Antimatter Pod, a Star Trek podcast about fashion, feminism, subtext, and subspace. Annika and Liz, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having us again.
Yes, it's so fun.
It's great to have you guys back aboard, and today we'll be talking about The War Without, The War Within, the 14th episode of the first season of Star Trek Discovery. Never in the history of the internet has so much ink been spilled over the issue of whether Star Trek Discovery is real Star Trek or not. At the very least, it's neck and neck with the issue of whether The Last Jedi is slash was good and or bad. Astute observers would most likely note the presence of the words Star Trek immediately preceding the word Discovery and consider the matter a fait accompli. The rest need look no further than Discovery's presentation of a world of spacefaring idealists, the wonder of the cosmos and humanity's boundless ingenuity, the emphasis on acceptance of differences and the repudiation of hate, and endless, endless scenes of two or more characters talking about those very things. Yes, virgins, there really is a Star Trek Discovery. But we'll talk about that a little later in the show. First, Annika and Liz, it's great to have you guys back on board. Your third appearance on the podcast. I've been listening to your show and enjoying your discussions about the third season of Star Trek Discovery, especially the episode Harlan Ellison's Angry Ghost. I'm trying to imagine if the recently, fairly recently departed Mr. Ellison, what his thoughts would be on that episode if he was alive. Not that they Not matter good. In any way.
You know, the thing about Ellison is he was a cranky old man, and his whole brand was that he was cranky and he hated everything. Yeah. And really the only person he seemed to get along with was J. Michael Straczynski of Babylon 5. So I He would have been well and truly in the Discovery is not real Star Trek and Discovery is bad, but also all Star Trek that I didn't write is bad club.
And he doesn't really like taking credit for what he did right because they messed it up.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. They ruined his vision.
Yeah, I can't imagine. Like, why is the Guardian of Forever wearing a hat? It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, no. I think I loved that episode and I loved what it did with the concept of the Guardian of Forever, which I think is a brilliant idea, and Harlan deserves every ounce of credit for it. But I don't think he would appreciate its evolution.
I have to, this goes probably beyond the scope of our discussion, but I have to wonder what the Guardian's game is, because, you know, in the episode, in the original series episode, Bones goes through, changes the past, and then he offers Kirk and Spock a chance to change it. And as soon as they get back out, he's like, another ride? You guys want to go again? It's like, no, of course we don't want to do that. And then the next time they do, it ruins the entire galaxy again.
It's interesting that he's like, oh, the Time War, I had to go and hide away from that, because it seems like it kind of would have been his whole jam.
You're right. Yeah. Right. Roll up, change history. try your luck.
Yeah. He's hiding the fact that he actually started and created the Time War.
Maybe that's what it is, yeah.
It wasn't that he wasn't there.
Archer.
Yeah, if you want to cross your fandoms, maybe he's like a representation of the Master or something like that from Doctor Who. He keeps messing with time.
I could see it. At the very least, they have like tea. They meet for tea and.
Right. Yeah. Compare notes.
Yeah.
Well, Annika, I know that you've started a new podcast called the Endless Anakin Playlist Podcast. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So this is a Star Wars podcast, although in three episodes, I've talked about Star Wars once. But it's basically I have been putting together a playlist or to use the old school, a mixtape for Anakin Skywalker for, 20 years, at least 15. And I've decided, and I also like never stop talking about Star Wars and particularly Anakin Skywalker. And I have a lot of opinions. They tend to be not the most popular opinions. For example, the prequels are my favorite Star Wars.
Interesting. Okay.
And so I decided that partially to, play around with more audio work, and also with different ways to put my thoughts out into the world. I've done blogs. I've written a lot of fan fiction. I have the podcast with Liz. And so I wanted to sort of, do a new fun way of doing it where the script outline, and then I sort of babble, and then I edit to make myself sound smart.
Sure.
Kind of podcast.
Right.
And I put it out on audio, Spotify is where I link it to, but it's, in Apple and all of the places. And then I also put a copy on YouTube because most of my Star Wars random friends are actually followers on my YouTube site. Okay. So I decided I would, put it out there as well.
Sure.
And I'm really, again, it's very new, but I'm definitely going to get through the first season. And then the second season, I have plans as well. So I'm hoping that I will have, at least 18 episodes, under my belt and be done. And hopefully more, because I could probably talk about Star Wars for ever. And they keep making more, so.
Yeah, I don't think you're going to run out of material anytime soon. Yeah. And you're composing music to be featured on the show as well?
Well, I actually, the song that I decided, I'm sure you have had this problem where you go looking for music that you can use for a podcast that you don't, if you pay for, you'd pay like $20 as opposed to 200 or whatever, and you can't use licensed music and all that sort of stuff. And so it ends up with being either you have something that doesn't really fit your show, or you have something that everybody's using, or it's just not special in any way.
Yeah.
And so I decided, why do that? I'll just use this song that I recorded myself.
That's a great idea.
I've had it. That's all. I've also had that for, 15 years, maybe not 15, maybe 10, but it's the music and lyrics are all by me. And I had a friend who helped me, mix it, record the different tracks. And then
sure.
They added the heartbeats. and I decided that why not use that? So it's Robots Don't Cry. And it is also available everywhere for sale. Or you can just listen on Spotify or wherever. And I'm really proud of it. And now that I've done that, and I did have to, pay to get it up on places, to distribute it.
Yeah.
I should record all my other songs now.
Sure.
since I did this, and I have an account.
Sure.
So we'll see. We'll see if I actually get to do that. But I do have a lot of songs.
That's great. People can find it by searching for Endless Anakin Playlist Podcast?
So, yes, okay. You can. It comes up. Just Endless Anakin is enough for it to come up on places. Or you can go to anakin.me and find all the links.
Oh, okay. Anakin.me. All right.
Anakin.me.
Yeah, like Endless Anakin might get you a 10-hour YouTube video of him just going, I hate you,
yeah,
over and over true. Again.
That would be hard for even me.
Yeah. Liz, are you able to talk about the book that you're working on?
The one we discussed last time I was with you has been submitted to an agent, and that was a month ago. And, she's like, you probably won't hear from me for 3 months. So I'm like, cool. I'm just going to check my email like 4 times a day in a completely normal and chill way.
Yeah.
And then I thought, well, it would be cool to have something else, and I don't like not writing, so I'm trying to write a middle grade fantasy heist set in a sort of a world that's loosely based on Renaissance Italy, because okay. I feel like that's a cool setting, and I love the idea of a heist. And it turns out that heists are really hard to write. Like, this is a very complicated genre. So, I'm going to end up watching Leverage again, just taking notes.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I think good heists are hard to write. You know, bad ones, yeah, you can just run off. But yeah, you have to get to that point where, oh, that's what it, everything makes sense now. They set this up in the first act.
Right, right. But at the same time, like, I mark everything draft zero. So if I go back to the beginning and like put all the clues in after I know what's happening.
Yeah, right.
No one else will know.
Yeah. I know you've written a lot of fic. Can you characterize how the process of writing a novel compares to writing fic?
One thing is that I do fic in Google Docs and I do original writing in Word. So there's that physical separation, even though I'm often sitting at the same computer.
Yeah, yeah.
Original fiction is, there's more of a process in terms of drafting. Like fic, I will write, I will revise it if I have to, but I don't do extensive rewriting. Whereas with something original, I really do have to go back and rewrite things and start from scratch. I think because the world building isn't there and it's quite a challenge, especially if most of your experience is in fic, it's quite a challenge to create original characters that people will care about. Mm-hmm. You know, that's sort of a skill that atrophies if you have only written fic, which I did for a very long time.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's just thinking about it differently, really. They're very similar, but I guess it's the difference between writing music and playing in a covers band.
Yeah, I suppose, yeah, it would be.
Yeah.
Developing your own world and characters and not having the shortcuts of, like, well, we know who, like, Kira is.
Yeah. I don't need to describe these characters because everyone knows what they look like.
Right, yeah. Open on ops. Yeah.
Just get yeah. going. Yeah. Both are fun. I love both.
Yeah. Annika, I know that you are watching Stargate for the first time.
Yes.
Is that is that progressing apace?
I have to admit the first season is not really grabbing me quickly.
Yeah. Yeah.
There are moments and people I've seen a lot of my friends have said that it gets better, that you sort of have to get over the beginning and then it becomes something more special.
Yeah.
So I'm sort of holding out for that. I'm not giving up on it. But I will admit that the first few episodes have been like, the first episode itself was sort of like, yikes. If I didn't have friends who were encouraging me, I don't know that if I would have continued.
Yeah.
After the pilot. But it's already sort of like they're starting to get the characters and having a better idea of maybe where they're going. And so I'm hopeful. And it's like, I think 7 seasons, six or seven, like there's a lot of it. So
yeah.
I feel like there wouldn't be that much and there wouldn't be so many people who love Star Trek who also love Stargate if it was just trash. Like
yeah.
It has to be good. So I'm continuing, but I will admit that I'm not like binging it. I can't watch more than one episode at a time because it's actually hard for me to pay attention sometimes.
Better or worse than TNG first season?
I mean, the problem with TNG first season is that I have a lot of nostalgia for
well, yeah.
It. You know, it was like super exciting to me to have Star Trek regularly and it's horrible. Like it is bad. I had a friend yell at me because I said bad things about the second season of TNG. And he was like, are you saying that the second season is the worst because have you seen the first season recently? I was like, yeah, I sort of see them as the same. Like the first and second seasons of TNG are sort of like you suffer through and every once in a while you get a gem.
Yeah.
But overall, it doesn't get there until at least the third season.
Okay.
And I don't think that's an unpopular opinion.
No.
No.
So that's why I'm willing to give Stargate a couple seasons to like get there. And there probably will be gems along the way. So
yeah. Yeah. I had never watched Babylon 5. And now that it's available remastered on HBO Max, you know, I've started to dive into that. And I'm having a similar kind of thing. Just, you know, having to assimilate like a brand new cast of characters in a world is one thing. But TV shows were different back then, especially TV shows in syndication. You know, like Star Trek had it good because they had a corporate parent in Paramount. And so you get a full season. But I watched the first episode of Babylon 5 without watching the original movie because I didn't know that that existed. And then I had to go hunt down the movie and watch that as well.
Oh, but the movie is terrible.
And yeah, and it is. It's really bad. And I'm like, I'm glad I didn't watch the movie first. Yeah. So, yeah.
I remember when it aired in Australia, that pilot movie, and my parents watched it. I was really keen to see it. And they're like, no, we're just, this is not the quality of television we want you to be watching. And I love Babylon 5. It is one of my favorite television shows. But it's also terrible and no one should watch it.
Yeah, that's the kind of standard that I'm going to have for my children. Not like content-wise, just like, this is below you. You can't watch this.
Yeah. Oh, my parents are also very strict about content. But absolutely, like if they thought something was trash, and they thought a lot of things were trash, like Deep Space Nine barely made it through, and only because it had Star Trek in the title.
Yeah. Liz, I've been watching the back and forth over the Facebook news blackout in Australia and trying to trying to understand it. I don't understand it because America has never said no to a corporation. We don't do that here. But a lot of people get their news from Facebook. I do.
Apparently.
And one in five people in Australia do. And the fact that they came to loggerheads over this meant that a lot of government Facebook pages that had actual advice for public health on the coronavirus and weather warnings, all of that got shut down.
You say that America has never said no to a corporation. The Australian government has never said no to the Murdoch Corporation. And this was this push for Facebook to pay to link to news sites was very much driven by the Murdoch Press and News Limited, as it is in Australia. So it's really two evil corporations fighting it out and the Australian government just straight up refusing to understand how the internet works. So this is really a fight that no one should win.
Yeah.
That's... I'm glad that it seems to have been resolved because so many like disability support groups were caught up in it. Trekmovie.com and TrekCore were caught up in it. I couldn't link to them from my Facebook page. It was ridiculous.
Well, thanks for that context there, because depending on the news outlet, you know, you're not going to hear about that Rupert Murdoch connection. So
no. Murdoch's ownership of our news goes much, much further than in the US. Most of our daily newspapers are owned by Murdoch.
Wow.
It's quite chilling, in fact.
Yeah.
That's like a dystopian future level right there.
And you're American.
Well, why did you choose this specific episode, The War Without, The War Within, to discuss today?
Katrina Cornwell.
Yes. Not really much debate about it. We figured we'd go for a Discovery episode because we know that you haven't had many guests covering it. And
yeah.
I think for both of us, this is more or less our favorite. Not necessarily the episode we consider the best, but I don't know about you, Annika, but certainly for me, it hits the right balance of interesting stuff to talk about, and also it hits my ear really, really hard.
Mm-hmm. I would say I have to re-watch some of season 3 to determine if it's my number one favorite, because I really enjoyed season 3.
Yes.
And none of it made me angry. But I think that my gut, this is certainly my gut instinct favorite episode, and certainly of the first two seasons.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's been a little while since I watched this one, and when I sat down to watch it for the first of a couple times, I was really surprised at how much it made me feel like it was Star Trek. Do you know what I mean? Like there's going to be a new feel to any kind of new Enterprise, so to speak. Mm-hmm. In the franchise, but like this just felt so much like Star Trek. And the resistance to new Star Trek shows, you know, it's nothing new, but the vociferousness of that response has been suspect to me. And I don't know the stats, but I'd like somebody, maybe Molly Petit, who's a statistician, who's a Star Trek fan, somebody should find a way to chart the negative reactions to TNG, DS9, et al., and see at what point the haters became lovers, or at least quieted down. And I know it's only been a few years since Disco's debut, but the continued insistence by some people that it's not Trek is just grating.
I think it's partially a quantity thing. You know, mm-hmm. they had seasons. The seasons in the 90s were twice the length of what we had now, mm-hmm. and ran for a much longer time. And I think in some ways the big gap between each season gives people more time to dwell on, Kurtzman, why hasn't he been fired yet? They said on YouTube yeah. that he had been fired 5 times.
Right.
And all of that.
It's also a social media thing. It's a lot easier to talk about Star Trek with a lot of people that you don't know.
Yeah.
And you get more attention if you say something negative. So I think there are some people who are actually against it, but I think that there is a contingent of the negative people who are just sort of, they just want to be negative and they just want people to listen to them and give them the satisfaction of being against something and like to tell them that yes, their opinion that the only real Star Trek is, you know, X, Y, and Z, to like validate that, to validate them.
Yeah.
Because they get that their personality and their persona like mixed up with their opinions and their fandom.
And it's hard to change your mind.
Yeah. So I think that we could have had these arguments on open, you know, web forums and Trek VBS and mailing lists and live journal, like arguments existed when all of this was on, you know, even in the 60s, people wrote to each other to argue over things. Sure. So it's not like it's new to be arguing or to be against something or to have strong feelings towards or against something, but it is a lot easier to debate now than it was.
Also, it's easier to go into spaces where people are being positive about something and tell them, actually, that thing you liked was really shit. Mm-hmm.
Which, yeah, it's such a weird impulse. I just don't understand.
I know. And I get the urge myself, and then I have to go and, you know, put my phone down and sit outside for a while.
Well, that's good of you.
I've been around fandom for a long time, and I have been that jerk. Yeah. And I think people just need to come to a point where they can learn from their behavior. Yeah. And that's increasingly hard because you sort of do develop a brand as your opinion becomes your brand, and therefore it's hard to change your opinion.
Right. It's difficult.
Certainly, I've developed a sort of comedy persona as a person who hates birds. I don't hate birds. I'm a little bit scared of them, but I don't hate birds. But if I turn around now and say, actually, birds are pretty great, then that all this work I've done over the years,
right,
making jokes about how awful birds are. Yeah, yeah.
Hating birds is my brand. I'm guessing
it's
that
a terrible brand. Don't make hating something your brand.
It's a unique brand, though. That has value. I'm guessing that the people who say these things, a lot of them haven't even watched the show. I found that a lot of the criticism of some of the less praised Trek series, whichever ones you think those are, is usually totally inaccurate. It's just people parroting complaints about something that they don't know anything about.
Absolutely true.
I certainly have much more interesting complaints about Enterprise now I've actually watched it.
Yeah, me too. And I don't think that, like, you know, the whole transaction of a piece of media is watching it, right? So if, like, you don't want to watch it or you feel like you wouldn't want to watch it, I wouldn't say that you can't say anything unless you got to watch it. But definitely, I think you need to know that your opinions are going to be uninformed unless you have watched it. If you really want to complain, then you got to watch the whole thing. At least give CBS All Access or Paramount Plus the money.
Yeah. It's interesting, though, because I see complaints from people who have watched Discovery who still don't seem to understand what they were watching. People say, oh, there's no utopianism. You know, they just find problems. They don't solve problems. And it's like, this is a long form piece of storytelling and you're judging it based on one single chapter.
Yeah.
It's hard to tell a week-to-week story on television and find the balance between resolving threads and keeping threads ongoing. Yeah. And I understand that pacing has never been Discovery's strength, but a lot of these complaints just, it feels like people don't actually pay attention, like they're on their phone or just not listening.
Or treating it like a TNG where you can skip like 8 episodes in a season and you're fine.
Right.
It doesn't matter. Nothing matters. Whereas Discovery, you really just can't pick and choose. You can't decide that you're not going to watch this week because, so this is how, in the second season, when Poe shows up again, my brother had not watched any of the short treks. And so she's like, it says previously on, and it shows her like a scene from the short treks. And he immediately like paused and texted me and was like, I don't remember watching this episode. I've never seen her before. Am I losing my mind? And I was like, oh no, it's short treks. And he was like, why would you do that? And it's like, well, they expect you to take the 10 minutes to watch her her episode on short treks.
Yeah.
But so
yeah,
it's another one of those things where it's harder to put in the effort to actually watch it, and a lot easier to just say, I don't like Discovery because they, you know, made up this, you know, they changed. I have one person who is very upset, like does not care about any of the quote unquote wokeness. Or the, you know, the funny makeup on the Klingons or any of this stuff, but is like horribly upset to the point of like screaming and like a, you know, physical, like a panic attack kind of thing over the fact that they can beam from one place to another without going to the transporter.
Right, right.
In the original series, they have to go to the transporter.
Yeah.
And I was just like, I didn't even notice. Like, that never occurred to me. I have no concept of anything about where you transport or these rules of transportation.
Right.
None of that matters to me. So it depends on what matters to you.
I will say, when this episode, The War Without, The War Within, aired, I was at work, naturally, so I was sort of following via the tag on Twitter, and a lot of people, when Cornwell beams in, a lot of people like, but she died, and I was like, no, Michael rescued her before they went to the Mirror Universe. Like, they had a whole conversation, there was a whole scene, you just weren't paying attention.
Yeah, and then we find out she's had 9 months of recovery, so yeah.
Right.
But we are talking about the Discovery episode, The War Without, The War Within, which first aired on February 4th, 2018. I choked on that a little bit because usually I'm talking about like the 80s or the 60s. But yeah, that was just 3 years ago. It was written by...
I'm still in the same job.
Yeah. It was written by Lisa Randolph. Randolph served as a co-executive producer for the second half of Discovery's first season. She also wrote the episode The Wolf Inside, which is kind of like part one of this episode, or at least a lot of the emotional conflicts. She's produced for shows like Rush, Rain, and Jessica Jones, and she's written for shows like The Shield, Being Human, Jessica Jones, and Prodigal Son. The episode was directed by David Solomon. This is Solomon's only work for Trek, but he's been directing TV since 1989, shows like Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Dollhouse, Once Upon a Time, and Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. He's also a producer and produced a series of made-for-TV Perry Mason films, as well as serving in various producing roles on Buffy the Vampire Slayer for its entire run. No star date for this episode, but of course the in-universe date is 2257. And your assignment, Annika and Liz, if you can, is to give us a 25-word synopsis of The War Without, The War Within.
Let's see.
Discovery returns home. Time has passed. That's 6 words.
The war is going poorly.
9.
So, at the advice of Emperor Georgiou, who you should never listen to, Sarek and Cornwell convince Starfleet to go on the aggressive.
I do love that Georgiou's advice is maybe, have you tried attacking? And the Federation is like, oh.
Yeah. I have to wonder, that's a good, great synopsis. I have to wonder about the, you know, obviously this is not written by military commanders, these shows. And so you wonder about the military tactics sometimes. But you also wonder about just having a war where you can appear, you know, from out of nowhere, from great distances away. It's not quite as confounding as it is, say, in the Star Wars universe, where you can just be hanging out and like, oh my God, a rebel fleet like jumps out of hyperspace. We had no idea they were coming. Because sensors seem to work a little differently in Star Trek. But the fact that the Klingons have taken over Starbase 1, 108, something that can be measured in astronomical units from Earth, like they're not in Earth's backyard, they're in Earth's attic, or they're like in the corner of Earth's family room. And then, of course, the Federation comes up with a strategy to like, why don't we just attack their capital planet? It's like, yeah, I mean, can we do that? Let's do that. Yeah. That's a great idea.
Is that allowed?
Yeah. Is that possible? Yeah, let's do it.
I mean, I think that's one of the Discovery is Star Trek points, is that they are not military. That's not how they think.
Yeah.
And I mean, I tend to argue that point, and I think that the Starfleet has a lot of military parts, but we can point to things like this, decisions like this. They, and even, you know, the pilot of Discovery, where we talk first, offer our hand first, we give the Klingons every opportunity to not go to war.
There's a real sense that they've had a century to become completely complacent and to just to lose their skills. War on this scale is completely theoretical to them, as opposed to the Dominion War, which is a much greater conflict, and they're coming off the war with the Cardassians and the fight with the Borg, and they've got all this history behind them. But also, I think Deep Space Nine had Ronald D. Moore, and he had been in the Navy and had some knowledge of military matters, and Discovery is a much more introspective show that doesn't really get into the nitty-gritty of what this war looks like.
Yeah. Plus it's, you know, they have a indispensable weapon, a ship that can appear anywhere at any time. So that would definitely upset the balance of a conflict like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And losing it for 9 months, having it taken off the table.
Right. Yeah, like, where'd those guys go? Here's some interesting facts from the memory banks about this episode, and feel free to jump in at any point with anything you'd like to add. This episode is, of course, still relatively fresh, so there's a lot of technical details, but not yet the kind of anecdotes that we usually talk about in this section. I can say that one of the best visual sequences in the episode, the terraforming scene, was initially storyboarded by the director, Solomon, and concept art was created for it by the art department. And creating the effects for this scene was a 3-month process, and series composer Jeff Russo didn't have a script or any previs to work from, but nevertheless, he composed a beautiful accompaniment to a beautiful sequence. And the piece, entitled Initiating, was included in the Disco Season 1 soundtrack release. We also find out in this episode that the ISS Discovery from the Mirror Universe was destroyed soon after its arrival in the Prime Universe. And I love the
idea. Really sad.
Yes, it's too bad. I love the idea that as soon as they got to the Prime Universe, they went out and picked a fight and just got blown up. It reminds me of the Mirror officers in Mirror, Mirror. You know, we cut back to that one scene in the Prime Universe in that episode, and it's just Mirror Kirk ranting in a Briggs cell. And I love the idea that even though our guys from our universe are upright and honest, they're a lot better at pretending to be bad than the Mirror guys are at pretending or even figuring out that they need to pretend to be good. Lorca would be the clear exception, but even he's good and bad at the same time.
And he's really pushing hard on the whole, I've been so deeply traumatized, I'm a different person.
Right. Idea. Yeah. If I do something mean or bad, that's my trauma. It's not that I'm from an evil universe.
Yeah.
There's also this question in this episode of the knowledge of the Mirror Universe in the Prime Universe. Of course, Kirk's Enterprise encounters the Mirror Universe, but we see that Cornwell in this episode has ruled all knowledge of it a secret. And here's where I totally lose the plot, because the Mirror Universe Empire should know about the Prime Universe because of the Defiant and all that.
And they do.
But yeah, but I can't remember at this point how they know that or how they employ it or... Does Giorgio say in previous episodes that they're aware of the Prime Universe?
It's knowledge that's classified to Terran captains and upwards.
Okay, yes. Okay. So remember that.
Captain Killy should have been aware, but obviously you don't. I imagine that there's some confusion and...
Yeah. Well,
but it's Sarek, not general knowledge.
Sarek has that great line in this episode when Cornwell is upset that she didn't know about Lorca, and he's like, well, him being replaced with a doppelganger from an alternate universe is not really the logical.
That wasn't the first guess. Yeah.
That's not what you're going to go for.
Yeah.
So I think I can imagine that even if people in the Mirror Universe know about it, that doesn't mean that they're going to assume it happened.
Yeah. It's a totally different situation on something like Lower Decks where forewarned is forearmed. So, you know, right. If they see a doppelganger, it's like, okay, Mirror Universe, is that what it is? Yeah.
Oh, I would love to see a Lower Decks Mirror Universe episode.
I have to wonder what the twist would be, though. They've got to do something. You know, the Mirror Universe has, like, discovered transcendentalism or something. They're all chilled out. And so everybody expects them to be evil, but they've shaved into, just soul patches now, and everything's cool over there.
Lot of hacky sack.
Yep. Let's talk about the guest stars in the episode. We've got Jane Brooke, of course, as Katrina Cornwell. Brooke would appear in a total of 12 episodes as Cornwell until her character's death in Such Sweet Sorrow Part 2. She's best known for her role as Dr. Diane Grad on Chicago Hope, and she's appeared in many TV shows and films since her film debut in 1987's Superman IV.
Not a great movie.
No, she plays the teacher of the schoolroom where the kid who writes the letter to Superman gets the idea for it. And it's just, I saw a video of this the other day. It's chilling because they're talking about the fact that we all exist in the shadow of nuclear annihilation. Mm. And she's just telling the kids, you might feel bad about that, but you know, write a letter or don't feel bad. And of course, in their world, they have Superman. So the kid's like, well, gosh darn it, I'm going to write a letter to Superman.
I mean, I would just send so many letters to Superman.
Yeah, every day. Just be a huge bag of letters. Mary Chifo appears as Laurel. Chifo appeared as Laurel in 13 episodes of the first and second seasons of Discovery. She got her start in film at the age of 3 with a role in Sandra Bullock's short film Making Sandwiches. And her mother, Beth Grant, a ubiquitous character actress, was also in that film. Chifo graduated from Juilliard, where she had Tilly actress Mary Wiseman as a classmate and Rin actor Noah Averbach-Katz as well. She had appeared in small roles or shorts before Star Trek Discovery, which was her first recurring role on a series. And James Frayne appears in the episode as Sarek. Frayne would appear as Sarek 8 times on Discovery, with archival footage of him appearing in the episode Perpetual Infinity. He would also portray the mirror version of Sarek, goatee and all, in The Wolf Inside. Frayne has had a prolific and eclectic career since his first role in 1993's Shadowlands, and he would go on to appear in many films and television shows, many of them period dramas, including a recurring role as Thomas Cromwell on The Tudors and the role of Theo Gallivan, a.k.a. Asriel, on Gotham. And this is one of those guys who I think pretty much everybody on Earth by now has seen him in something. He's in a lot of stuff.
He is definitely a hey, it's that guy.
Yeah.
Because I have to tell everyone about this. He is the love interest in Where the Heart Is.
Oh, my gosh.
No one would ever remember that. So I have to, like, let everyone know. Where the Heart is a 2000 film starring Natalie Portman and Ashley Judd.
Right.
Who is also in Star Trek. And it is... The Walmart baby movie, if anyone's heard of that.
Yes.
And James Frayne is Natalie Portman's love interest. And when I figured that out, I had like a party. I made cupcakes. I was so excited that James Frayne was that character.
He's just not a love interest type.
No. And he's not like he's a weirdo in the movie, you know, that's like his entire character.
Sure.
But it's so exciting to me that he played that role. And I love that movie. It's not great, but it's wonderful. And I think everyone should go watch it. If you like James Frayne as Sarek, you can like sort of squint and consider it a Sarek Amanda, like, you know, AU version.
I gotta see that. It'd be interesting to see him play that kind of role. He's usually wearing a robe and like coldly dissing somebody. But yeah, that would be interesting. Well, let's talk about the episode itself, and talk is the key word here. As a weekly series that explores issues of philosophy and ethics, but one that is constrained by the budget limitations of a syndicated series, Star Trek has never met a tete-a-tete it didn't like. And this episode is, I think, a masterclass of using dialogue and character interaction to underline the themes that the show has been exploring, and also to do all those things that you use dialogue for, setting up future conflicts, maneuvering characters to points of emotional epiphany. This episode does all of those things. And as I was getting ready to talk about this episode on the show, I tried to make a breakdown of all the one-on-one or two or three on-one scenes of the episode and what the characters wanted in each of those exchanges. And I don't know if I accomplished anything because there's so much happening and so many things passing back and forth in the dialogue scenes of this episode.
There are a lot of individual conversations, absolutely, which is great. As much as I don't pay attention to transporter rules or when people ask me, you know, what's your favorite version of the Enterprise? I'm like, there's a difference. So I love all the characters. That's why I watch Star Trek. It's why I watch any series. And so many characters get to act off of each other in so many different ways in this episode. It's really like, I too was writing a list of, you know, it was like, okay, so I wanted to talk about Sarek and Kat, and I want to talk about Sarek and Georgiou and Sarek and Michael and Kat and Laurel and Michael and Kat and Michael and Ash. And, you know, it's like a whole list, and they all happen in this, like everybody gets a scene or scenes with each other. And it's, and then, like you mentioned before, there's that beautiful sequence where no one talks. While the terraforming goes on. And that, it's like, it's so amazing that both of those things happen in this episode. Like, that's why this is one of my favorites, is because it feels like a masterclass in storytelling with different ways of how to tell stories, big group scenes and small individual scenes and silent scenes and the twist at the end. So
it really feels like, after the sort of chaos and separation and shocking revelations of the Mirror Universe, everyone is coming together to catch up and sort of reestablish themselves and lay the groundwork before we go into the finale, which is another big episode with a surprising amount of talking in its own right. But still, this is where all the character stuff is set out.
And it's coming off the laser fest of the last, you know, two episodes of intrigue in the Mirror Universe, and yet they're paying some of that stuff off, but also dealing with what's going on. And it's really impressive how, even in just this hour, they give, we see characters kind of complete arcs. And so, you know, you've got Burnham, you know, we survived, you know, a universe of evil and a ship with a sun powering it. But I got my ex-boyfriend's here and I got to deal with that. And I love the fact that she's like, you have to order me to talk to him. I'm not going to talk to him.
Love that.
Yeah. And over the course of the episode, which is in a lot of ways exploring the fact that we, you know, we're a family on the ship, also, you know, loving, we have to love our enemies in a way as much as we love our friends. And she is sort of kind of turned around and forced to go back to talk to him. And it doesn't end well. I mean, they could have easily just made it, oh, I'm so glad that you're not a Klingon anymore. Oh, thanks for forgiving me. It does not end that way at all.
No. They really... I expected a storyline where Michael, as a woman and as a black woman, was expected and required to forgive Ash and basically do his work for him. And all through the episode, people are trying to push her into that role, and she's standing firm and saying, no, I can't do this for my own sake, and it is bad for him if I do this work for him. And I really respect and love that choice.
I think that trauma is something that gets explored a lot in Discovery, certainly in the most recent season of Disco, but certainly here in the first season as well. And from Tyler / Voke's experiences to, you know, Stamets' loss of Culber, to Michael's loss of Georgiou and her regret over her actions at the Battle of the Binary Stars, I don't want to say that they're wasn't any examination of pain in earlier Trek. There certainly was. But most things worked themselves out, and then we started the next hour fresh. Mm-hmm. Do you think
only Picard has ongoing trauma?
That does have it too. Yeah. Do you think that that's solely the consequence of having a non-serial syndicated format, or are we more interested now in examining pain and loss in TV?
I think it's a combination, because I do think that when you have to wrap everything up at the end of your 48-minute show, you almost have to hand wave trauma in order for that to happen. Mm-hmm. And so it is a form of the storytelling, but I also think that we are more, like, on a societal level, we are more open to discussing feelings in general. It doesn't even have to be like trauma and loss, but just like actually having an emotional arc is something that wasn't a part of television. It wasn't, we talk about procedurals, and I love procedurals. Like, I will never stop talking about Law and Order, but the having a routine, having a procedure that you follow, doesn't mean that you can't have an emotional connection to it.
Right.
And SVU is still on, and original Law and Order is not. And that's because SVU, because it was about trauma, they couldn't hand wave it at the end. You can't put on a show that is literally about, mostly sexual trauma and say, well, but then we're going to move on and not talk about it. It's like, no, that doesn't work for this.
Yeah.
And it went on longer than the original, because people respect that are pulled into that. And shows like that opened up the opportunities to then take something like trauma that does exist in TNG and in Picard's arc, but only for Picard and only in very certain specific times. Like, there are plenty of episodes in between Best of Both Worlds and All Good Things where he does not act like someone where that happened to.
Yeah, and Deep Space Nine has so many episodes where Kira is forced to bond with and eventually form a relationship with men who were involved in the desolation of her planet and the attempted genocide of her people. And it just keeps happening over and over again. And here it's like Michael is saying, no more of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I only wrote one fragment of a sentence under Michael and Ash, and it's, she tells him he has to work on himself. And I felt lighter than I had in years. Like,
yeah,
I felt like I was Michael saying, these are my boundaries, and I'm not going to, you don't get to cross them.
Yeah. I'm not going to be your codependent interspecies girlfriend. Sorry. Yeah.
Yes. Which, that is a story that I would really enjoy in fic, but not for these characters. Hmm. And I think it is so great to see a story about a black woman setting a boundary, and ultimately it's respected. Discovery sort of started out looking like it was really going to explore different types of trauma, with Michael's childhood trauma and then Lorca and Ash's different types of war trauma. Yeah. And two of those guys were not actually that traumatized, which was really uncomfortable. And then this episode comes in and we're still with Michael, and now Kat seems to have some element of war trauma affecting her decision making. Mm-hmm. And Sarek is so deeply damaged that he's become a supportive parent. And it sort of nods to the promise of the premise that we read into the earlier episodes.
Yeah.
One of my favorite scenes in all of Discovery, really, is when they get to Starbase One and Admiral Cornwell is visibly, like, she's unable to deal with what's happened. Mm. She momentarily shuts down to the point where she can't command, she can't make a decision. And it's just that brief moment, but it's so powerful. That's, you know, how I can reconcile, like, oh yeah, they were at war for 9 months and they're losing. Like they have been losing all 9 months because the only ship that they had that was capable of attacking the Klingons on their own terms was Discovery, and Discovery was gone.
Yeah.
And also that she as an individual went from being a POW to a leader in this war that they can't win.
Yeah.
And right. Certainly she blowing up the Klingon homeworld is not a great decision to make, and I will have a rant about that later on. But I know that there were a lot of complaints that, oh, you know, this is why women shouldn't be in charge, or this is sexist writing. And it did not feel like that to me. It felt like a realistic depiction of a commander who is no longer fit for duty, but there's no one else to take her place.
Yeah.
And we saw heaps of those guys in TOS. Basically everyone from this generation goes mad. So I don't think it's gendered.
That's interesting because she's one of like maybe the only admirals that we get that isn't totally evil or self-serving. And
no,
the idea that's something that's maybe baked into the admiralty after all these horrible wars and stuff like that they just become so self-serving.
I just assume that she was their only mental health professional in the whole of Starfleet. And when she switched to command, they just couldn't cope.
the office is empty.
Yeah.
I like that when you have an honorable admiral character, then you can actually, you know, explore things like that character having to do questionable things like attack Kronos, lie about the mirror universe, you know, pretend that, you know, Kelpian eating Georgiou is the prime Georgiou. Like those choices highlight much more the burdens of command, I think, in making the quote unquote right choice instead of the right choice.
Yeah, it's interesting because I'm a big defender of Admiral Nechayev, who also made a lot of really questionable decisions. You know, she is the face of the policy of moving settlers from the demilitarized zone.
Yeah.
She orders a genocide against the Borg. And she was just absolutely excoriated by fandom. And to this day, there are really mean, sexist, even misogynistic remarks made about her.
Yeah.
And I feel like Cornwell is a modern take on a very similar character. And she is much more popular.
I love, too, that she just takes the chair when she gets on Discovery. Yeah. There's none of this demurring, like, oh, no, it's your captain, it's your ship. She's just like, yeah, get up.
No, sorry, Saru.
they don't have a captain. And she's like, okay, now you do.
Yeah.
I mean, and more power to her.
And she's good at it. She's perfectly, like, obviously not in fit mental health, but as a captain, she's supportive and listens to her crew and does a perfectly good job.
Yeah.
Mostly.
And just to the point of someone who has been traumatized being in charge, we also have Sarek, who, like, first of all, is not even a military leader of any kind.
No!
He's ambassador to Earth. I mean, obviously part of it is because they had the character, they had the actor, like it was a story plot decision, I think.
Yeah.
But it's also, you know, I'm a huge fan of if you make a decision for plot reasons, you have to then make it make sense for a character. Like you have to make it make sense for the reality of the story.
Sure.
And so what I get out of that is that no one would choose Admiral Cornwell and Sarek to be in charge of all of Earth's armies, all of Starfleet. Like no one would say these are the best possible people for this, you know. But
it's like if the Dominion War got to the point that Lashana Troi was running Starfleet.
So that's where we're at. We're at the point where these two are in charge and all of Starfleet is willing to compromise because they are that desperate. They are at the point, they are at the breaking point.
And this is my other point about Kat giving the order to blow up Kronos. the suggestion came from Georgiou to Sarek, and it's Sarek who takes it to the Federation Council. So while it may have been an illegal order from the Federation Council that Kat should not have followed, she does not bear sole responsibility for that choice.
Yeah.
And I feel like she takes too much of the blame and Sarek not enough.
Interesting.
I just think ultimately a military commander is answerable to the civilian government.
You know, the question of identity is constantly explored in Discovery, sometimes overtly, like, you know, we are Starfleet, almost a mantra that, you know, reminds us of our ideals. But characters on TNG or DS9, you know, would change and grow sometimes due to the circumstances. But Disco immediately sets out questions of who am I really, with Burnham being raised by Vulcans and Tyler being a secret Klingon, Tilly wanting to make captain. Saru being somebody who is naturally fearful in a job that requires intrepidity. And Sarek is a man who knows who he is, or at least he's fairly sure he does. And I love when he goes to see Georgiou, or sorry, he's summoned to see her. They're kind of having a fight between exes that never were. Like, Georgiou's kind of questioning how he's raised Burnham, and he's like, yeah, my Burnham saw through Lorca, and she got her crew back home and really messed up your empire, so I think my daughter's doing okay.
Yeah, yeah. Secretly, I'm very proud of all of my children. Yeah, don't tell them I would die if they
didn't. I would absolutely explode, but yeah. And I love, too, what he says to Burnham when he leaves. I think that you can argue that, you know, the Vulcan way of parenting isn't the best way, especially for a human child, but his statement to her about never needing to regret loving someone is some of the best parental advice I've ever heard.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I realize that Sarek is not really a good parent to any of his children, but he tries so hard to do what he thinks is right for them. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of a shame that he's sort of written off as the worst dad in Star Trek when obviously that is Worf, who barely tries at all.
Yeah, it's not a question.
Yeah.
He does try, and I think that I love Sarek, and I love Sarek and his children and the different ways that that goes and the different ways that he acts. I love that I agree that don't be afraid of loving someone, Michael, is wonderful advice. And it's something she needs to hear, even if she didn't go and speak to Ash ever again. Like, she shouldn't feel any shame for it having happened.
Yeah.
And that is so un-Vulcan in every way. It's like the least Vulcan thing possible. And in that one moment, Sarek realized that he had to treat her like a human. And It was sort of this, oh, wow, Sarek, you could be good at this if you just put in a little bit more effort and realize that you have to treat people like individuals and not concepts.
I think this is a common problem for a lot of parents. But in that moment, I also saw the man who has been married to a human for a long time. And I saw why Amanda loves him. Because I do kind of joke a lot about what does Amanda see in him, but that moment made it clear.
I like that idea that it's not, the end point isn't you reconciling and getting back together with Ash. It's you walking away from this, not damaged in your ability to love or being afraid of that.
Right, right. Yeah.
And he gives her the Vulcan hug at the end. He puts his little hand on her shoulder. Boop.
I know.
That's like a full body hug for a Vulcan.
I honestly think that they have Sarek and his children, they have the best relationship.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
It works out the best. And it's partly, I think, because she's more like him and also less like him. And so it works out for her. Like, she gets the Sarek who is willing to let the mask slip a little.
Also, I think because she is visibly not Vulcan, it's harder for him to fall into the trap of going, why aren't you a proper Vulcan?
Discovery, Star Trek as a whole, but Discovery certainly is definitely about the family that we choose. And Tyler certainly is outside of that family in this episode. He's got it rough. Mm-hmm. One of my regrets about the transition to the future in season 3 is the apparent lack of movement on the Section 31 show is that we don't get to explore Tyler's continued evolution. You know, in this episode, Saru says that he won't imprison Tyler for Volk's crimes, but it doesn't mean that he's the employee of the month on the ship.
Yeah, no.
And we get that great scene where, you know, of course it's Tilly, but Tilly just says, well, screw it. I'm going to eat. It's the lunchroom scene. I'm going to eat lunch with them. And everybody joins in. And it's a great contrast to where Burnham was when she first came aboard Discovery. And on Lorca's ship, she was completely a pariah. You know, she got in a fight. Like, nobody would accept her. So this is a different ship now.
It's funny you say that, because Annika and I really dislike that scene. Like, I completely buy that Tilly would join Ash, but having everyone then get up to join them felt really unearned.
Well, it doesn't count, Kayla. Tilly already did it, so, but...
Yeah, and then I can't remember which bridge guy Kayla is having lunch with, but his face says, I'm only doing this because of peer pressure. And, like, clearly we need to talk about peer pressure on this ship, because that's a big problem.
Interesting.
But I hadn't thought to contrast that with the reception of Michael, and that kind of makes me feel better about that scene if I tell myself it's not so much about Ash and everyone forgiving him as people regretting the way they treated Michael.
Yeah.
And wanting to not repeat that.
I mean, I guess, but she's not even in that scene. And
no.
It feels performative if the only reason they're doing it is because they have guilt over how they treated Michael, and now they've decided they like Michael. I like what Aaron said, that when Michael came on board, she was on Lorca's ship. I do like the idea that this is no longer Lorca's ship, and that's what's changed. And that did start in the earlier episodes in the Mirror Universe, and Saru does give that really great speech.
Yes.
We are Starfleet, and right. And so there is movement towards that. So I can see it, and I can, you know, given that scene in the earlier episodes, and knowing that the next episode they make their big We Are Starfleet stand and, you know, change the course of the war.
Yeah.
Like, seeing those bookends, this scene is better.
Yeah.
Because it fits into sort of like a little trilogy of the story we're trying to tell. Taken on its own, I just really, it rubs me the wrong way, in the same way that I really love that Michael puts up the boundaries and says, yeah, Ash, we're not going to have the same relationship, and I'm not going to help you get to a place where we can have the same relationship. You do that on your own, and then we'll talk. And this scene where they're sort of like, hey, Ash, you know, ha ha ha, that was so funny when you murdered Culver. Like, on an individual personal level, it just doesn't make sense to me.
And it reminds me of the farewell scene for Georgiou, where everybody loves her and everybody misses her. And I don't think that, like, the bridge crew should not have the same relationship with each other and the main characters as the audience. And this maybe feels like bridge crew as audience stand-in going too far.
Yeah.
And I will say, so for Ash, of every character, I agree that I'm sad that we don't get more Ash, because he finally became someone that I could really get behind. I really liked where his story was going. I was excited about how he was becoming that sort of dual person. Like, he had these memories as Vulcan, these memories as Tyler, and how they play off of each other. And he looked better. Like, the second season Ash is, he's the only character that's improved in second season. And so I'm just upset that just as he was getting good, he was sort of shuffled off, and, you know, there's no guarantee that we'll ever see him again.
Yeah. I really do hope that he turns up in Strange New Worlds so I can finally get the awkward brother meets ex-boyfriend scene with Spock. I know they stood next to each other at various points in season two, but did they interact?
No connection.
Would love Spock being the Tilly in the scene and welcoming Tyler to the Enterprise or to, like, his little squad, because Spock does know what it's like to be both two people at once and
human and outsider, something else.
You know, yes. Human and something else, human and unable to, like, to pass as one thing, but everyone knows that you're not. And it's like, and they have really weird expectations for you.
And also, Spock doesn't have the strong prejudice against Klingons as, say, Jim Kirk. Yeah. It would be interesting if we can look forward to Star Trek VI and go, oh yeah, Spock knew how to build peace with the Klingons because he had this relationship with Ash Tyler.
I love that idea. That like me, I'm tearing up at the idea that it's because of Ash that Star Trek VI happens.
I'm just going to say at some point in the near future, we really should do a Star Trek VI episode purely because I want to rewatch it.
Mm. Hey, stop planning your show on my show.
Sorry.
I like that bit of retroactive canon. I also, I want to go back into Star Trek II and insert a line about Carol Marcus using the Stamets procedure or his research or something like that, because they terraformed that moon real fast. That's like some Genesis level terraforming.
Yeah, and I wonder if Marcus was aware of Stamets's research, because she would be approximately Tilly's age.
Yeah.
So maybe she's like, mushrooms? Really? Mushrooms? But very into the terraforming side.
Yeah.
Stamets and his research exists up to the point where Discovery disappears. So, like, it would still, those things would still be available. And it's almost like she could find that and take it to the next level.
Sure.
You know, it's like, why did no one ever follow up on Stamets's research? You know, just because he died doesn't mean that we have to stop.
Yeah.
What happened to that guy anyway?
He died, and then there's another researcher named Stahl who's like, that's not good. Don't use that. But she's like, maybe there's something here.
Yeah. No, I like that retroactive canon.
Discovery, as we get near the end here, I just wanted to say that I think Discovery has, over the course of its run, and a little more in its third season, ever so slightly begun to try to critique the utopia of the Federation with mixed results. And there's an interesting exchange between Laurel and Cornwell in the episode where Laurel levels the accusation that the Federation is a great force for universal homogenization and assimilation.
Yes.
Big words for Klingon. And I think the franchise has always been a little reluctant, naturally, to pop the bubble of its utopia. But what do you think of the critique of the Federation as a leveler, a force of assimilation?
I think it's in general true. And Darren Mooney likes to point out that in Matters of Glory, Heart of Glory, you know, the season one Next Generation episode with the Klingons, the Klingon rebels are like, ever since we allied ourselves with the Federation, we have lost our Klingon spirit, we've become soft, we've become too much like them. Right. And that's partially, you know, a make the Klingon Empire great sort of attitude, but I do think that there is a lot of truth to it. And it's not necessarily a bad thing. Like, we understand from Star Trek VI that there are what we should not call human rights violations happening in the Klingon Empire, and it would be better if that was not the case. But at the same time, you do want them to an extent remain Klingon. And I do understand Laurel's concerns.
And I would say that that is sort of universalized amongst all of the alien races. Because in Deep Space Nine, Bajor chooses not to join the Federation because they're afraid of becoming humanized, basically.
Yes.
Yeah.
And we know that the Romulans had a really rough time in the Picard era because they refused to assimilate, basically.
Yes.
And so these stories are they exist, you know, throughout. Even in Enterprise, the Andorians have the same sort of like, we want a Federation, but we don't want a human. Like, we don't want Starfleet to be
not with those Tellarites,
I was just going to say, it's interesting how in Enterprise, the Andorians and the Vulcans are much more alien and culturally different from humans than in series set later. And I don't know how much of that is intentional, and I don't know how much of that is simply that we're seeing humans meeting these guys for the first time. But it does seem like you join the Federation and you do sort of just become another ingredient in the melting pot. And that, to an extent, that is fine. That is great. You know, I live in a multicultural society, and as you guys do as well. But the challenge is always to find a balance between sharing common culture and common goals versus retaining what is important of your own identity.
And the Vulcans have this as well, certainly. I mean, even in Amok Time, T'Pring basically says she doesn't want to marry Spock because she doesn't want to be like she doesn't want to be Spock's wife. She wants to be a Vulcan. She wants to have her own identity, and so she doesn't want to be married to a legend. And in the tie-in novel Spock's World, Vulcan wants to leave the Federation. They want to secede from the Federation. And we learn, you know, in Discovery Season 3 that Vulcan eventually did leave the Federation, or like chose not to rejoin or whatever. But basically they cut ties because, you know, they wanted to take care of themselves. And so it's like Vulcan isolationism is a thing.
Yeah. And Vulcan supremacy.
Yeah, so, I mean, and to answer, like, the original question, I have always, from the beginning, been the, you know, beating the drum that the Federation is not great, actually. and so I think that the idea of a united Federation of planets, when you say it like that, is really, you know, it's a lovely utopian concept, but the reality of the situation is you get a lot of these like Brexiters and you get stuck in these conversations of, well, what part of yourself are you willing to give up in order to become the kind of person that the Federation like is a we are Starfleet, like what are you going to give up of yourself so that you can be this greater ideal? And it's like, what if the greater ideal meant that no one ever had to give up any part of their self, and we just, you know, really believed in Iddick instead of pretend believed in Iddick?
Yeah.
I have this recurring rant about the legendary root beer scene in Deep Space Nine, because the thing is, root beer is a uniquely American drink. You don't get it in Australia unless you buy root beer that has been specially imported from the US. So if you go, oh, the Federation is just like root beer, it's just such a US-centric piece of writing. Yes. You know, the Federation is tea, the Federation is coffee, the Federation is wine or spirits or...
I mean, you know, not to feel like flippant, but the fact that Jean-Luc Picard, the Frenchman, is played by Patrick Stewart, the British man, it's sort of like, well, it's not actually important that he's French. Like, that has nothing to do with anything.
The fact,
you know,
that
all of Europe is a monolith, according to Star Trek.
Yes. It's supposed to be, but like you see that, and your comments about like just the hegemonic, you know, infection of Americanism in the Federation is totally valid. Yeah. But
and for the record, I really enjoy root beer.
No, yeah, root beer's great. But what really frustrates me is that we still see, you know, in the 60s, what you're describing was great. That was enough. That's exactly what we wanted. And we have a real tendency, and I think it's an important one, to question our leadership, to question our form of government. We're asking a lot of important questions right now. And I think that reflects itself in storytelling. But I don't feel like any criticism of the Federation has ever stood on its own, at least ones proposed by the franchise itself. And so I wonder if that will ever really get traction as something, you know, they had their chance. A thousand years go by in season 3 and the Federation is in shambles, and all they want to do is just put it back together. But something that really bugs me is that, like, you have this, and this is like in the DNA of the franchise, I think, and we need to take it out. You have a multicultural crew. You've got, you know, people of all faiths, walks of life, skin colors, and that sort of thing. But they're all kind of like divvied up still. Like the fact that, Sulu is born in Japan. It's like, why can't he be born anywhere?
Yeah,
like, if everybody is everywhere now, hey, why does Chekhov have to be Russian and he's born in Russia?
Not to be a Star Trek nerd, but Sulu was born in San Francisco.
Oh, that's right. I picked the wrong guy. I guess I should have said Uhura.
Scott
Uhura, being born in Africa,
and or even all valid.
Fast forward 50 years, Owoshakun born in Nigeria. And I know that she lives in like a weirdo Luddite like cult or something like that, but like that could be anywhere. It doesn't, we're still, it's like this separate but equal kind of thing. And it doesn't show like the reality of the human diaspora and the reality of just people being divorced from borders and lines that I think you would see on a United Earth.
I definitely wish that we saw more colonists in the Federation, in Star Trek, who are human but have no particular emotional ties to Earth. You know, Earth was where they went to study and that's it. Yeah. That was sort of my headcanon for Kat, and I sort of like to overlook the bit where in this very episode she talks about Earth as her homeworld.
Yeah.
also mentions Jonathan Archer's name, and that always makes me really happy. Just want to say.
I know. Because you love your trash captain.
I love my trash captain. and I love the idea that he is in some ways related to Kat, either actually or, like, you know, he was a hero of hers. Like, I don't really care how.
Yeah.
Okay, but this is Jonathan Archer. He is a hero to no one.
Oh. Well, I'm glad the show's over. I'm about to kick you off.
No. See, the problem with Jonathan Archer and why he's such a wonderful trash captain is that he's a hero to everyone. Yeah. That's why everything that's wrong in the Federation is Jonathan Archer's fault. Yep.
Okay, I'll get behind that.
I will say before we wrap up, I still have hopes that the Section 31 show will be a place to sort of interrogate the assumptions underlying the concepts of the Federation. Mm. And part of the reason for that is that one of the showrunners is Bo-Yon Kim, who will be not only the first non-American showrunner for a Star Trek, but the first whose second language is English, who is from outside the Anglosphere.
Yeah.
I think that we've seen in her writing for Discovery that this does bring an interesting context to her work.
Yeah.
And I'm really eager to see how it plays out when and if Michelle Yeoh is ever available to film.
Yeah.
And I will say, I didn't know that Lisa, I forgot her last name, wrote this episode. And that she also wrote Jessica Jones. But, like, now that I know that, because, again, I don't pay attention to, like, credits any more than I pay attention to ships. I apologize to everyone involved. But, like, now that I know that, it's like, of course, because only a woman would write that scene with Michael and Ash.
It makes a lot of sense. Yeah, it does.
And the fact that she also worked on Jessica Jones, which is, like, literally Trauma, the television series.
And also a series where women have conversations with each other all the time.
Right, yeah.
So, like, of course, you know, Laurel and Kat got to have that great scene. Of course, like, it's just really, it makes perfect sense to me. And it's sad to me that I didn't make that connection beforehand.
Well, that's what watching credits gets you.
Yeah.
But we have you to tell us what's in there.
Yeah, well, I'm happy to provide that service.
Thank you. We'll expect an email after every episode.
Well, I'll get right on it. I'll get a Substack going with that. Well, we talked previously on the show about your favorite captains. Annika's was Janeway, and Liz abstained from the question.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think that Janeway would have dealt with this situation, Annika, if she was put in Cornwell's shoes? Would she have made a similar choice?
Absolutely, 100% Janeway.
I think so too. I think she would have come up with the idea of attacking Kronos.
Yes, yeah. It would not, like, she wouldn't wait around, and also it would have happened because she's also, like, Janeway is really bad at. She's like one of those people we were talking at the beginning of the show who, like, can't change their opinions.
Yeah.
Also, she would have basically recruited Laurel to join the crew.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah,
like that is the only difference between how Janeway and Cornwell would handle this.
Yeah. Her ship would be like the old no smoking lights on planes. She'd have a prime directive, you know, slash through it. That light's on for this mission.
Yeah.
Liz, who do you think would be the perfect captain to end the war as we see it in the show?
Oh, gosh. Sisko. Like, he's not my favorite captain because I don't have a favorite captain, but I think Deep Space Nine demonstrates that he is an adept military commander who is good at keeping what I'm going to apologetically call humanitarian concerns in mind as he makes hard decisions.
I think
he fully would have been up for blowing up Kronos, but he would, like Kat, he would have welcomed a plan B as soon as it presented itself.
I agree with that. Well, at the end of the show here, you'll both receive a promotion to the rank of lieutenant. And we've talked about the departments that you're employed in. Annika working as a counselor. How would you counsel a human that is part Klingon and part mass of physical and psychological trauma?
I would love the opportunity. That sounds amazing. I think that, see, I wouldn't treat Ash any different than I'd treat anyone, because I think all of us are actually a mash of different personality traits, you know, and what our experiences are how we were raised, and, you know, when we went away from our parents, you know, what were our first experiences with that, what we did in college, how we built our own identity. Like, all of that can be also sort of seen as, hey, that one time that a Klingon like took over your personality. Like, that's just another thing that happens. Like, that's what's so great about sci-fi, is you can have these completely ridiculous concepts, like things that happen. Like, this is why I love WandaVision so much, is because absolutely everything is like, it's crazy. She like brings people back to life and like creates imaginary children for herself, which is nuts and very sci-fi. But what matters is why.
Yeah.
And all of us who have lived through the past year in the pandemic can 100% relate to where Wanda is in that moment.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't treat Ash any differently than I would treat anyone else. But I think that I could actually learn a lot about the human spirit, quote unquote, from having those conversations.
Liz, you were the assistant to an admiral. Let's say that Cornwell pulls you aside and says, all right, we're going to pretend like the cannibal empress is our Georgiou. Does that make you want to transfer? And if not, what in Disco would make you consider a career in replicator repair?
I definitely would have to have some serious thought about passing off the cannibal Georgiou as the real one. But honestly, I probably would have been putting in for my transfer right around the time that my boss started phasering bowls of fortune cookies.
Which is so weird. I never understood the fortune cookie thing. I don't know, unless it's, I don't get it. I've got a million theories and none of them make sense. And I don't know if it's just a thing that was like left over from like Brian Fuller, you know, has these crazy ideas and he's like, and he's got fortune cookies on his desk.
The thing is, like, Lorca disappears and suddenly we learn that Discovery has in fact had a briefing room all along, and what, Lorca just kept fortune cookies there because he likes a snack. He gets really cranky when his blood sugar drops.
What I want to know is, how did Mira Lorca know that Prime Lorca had this fortune cookie thing going on?
I assume because he landed on... He landed on the Buran and was like, oh yeah, hey, my fortune cookies are still here. I just think in the Mirror Universe, he has evil fortune cookies.
Yeah, what do the fortune cookies say? Help, I'm trapped in a Mirror Universe?
Oh my gosh. Like, can you imagine the evil fortune cookies?
Your unlucky numbers, yeah.
Yes. For the record, I think I would prefer to work for Admiral Vance. He seems pretty chill and rarely in danger of getting blown up and seems to take a hard line against passing off cannibal Mirror Universe people as their real counterparts.
Yeah, he's not
I'm
down with that.
I'm super annoyed at how much I like Admiral Vance.
I know. I'm like, you can't just give me another admiral and tell me it's the same. Like, I'm not, I know the difference. And yet I love him.
I love him.
Yeah.
They're quite different characters, though. Like, I feel like if Kat had somehow survived and got into the future with Discovery, like, she and Admiral Vance would be rivals turned bros.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's a fic to start working on, I think.
I mean, I've already had some ideas in that direction. The point is, I can love more than one admiral at a time. I just need them to not be blown up.
Yes. Yeah, that helps. Well, Lieutenants Dane and Barr, thanks for joining me to talk about Star Trek and the Star Trek universe. If people want to continue the conversation, and they can, at EISTpod on Twitter and the Enterprising Individuals Facebook page, where can people find you online?
Our Ask box is open on Tumblr. That's antimatterpod, all one word, .tumblr.com. And you can also find our episodes and increasingly transcripts for our episodes.
Oh, woo! Great. And people should check out the Endless Anakin playlist podcast on Spotify as well.
And let's see if we can get Robots Don't Cry into everyone's end of the year Spotify wrap up.
Well, thanks again for joining me. We're signing off until the next mission. Hailing frequencies closed.